Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Bio is our monthly series where we take a big, deeply researched and detailed biography and break it down over the course of the week so we can take time to really discuss and think about the work. This week we are digging into a 781-page biography called His Very Best, Jimmy Carter, A Life, by award-winning author and filmmaker Jonathan Alter. The book is the first full-length independent biography of Jimmy Carter. Today, Jonathan will fill us in on Carter's early adulthood and first steps into politics. As a local prominent farmer and businessman, Carter saw that civic leaders could make a difference in the world, so he set out to run for Georgia State Senate in 1962. He would find himself struggling with two issues still present today, race and voter fraud. When it looked like he lost his re-election to the Georgia State Senate, it was revealed his opponent's supporters had literally stuffed a ballot box. And as he pursued higher office, the governor's seat, his desire to get elected in the South meant he would do something that seems at odds with his moral compass. Jimmy Carter avoided the civil rights movement altogether, opposed busing as a solution to segregation, associated with George Wallace, and even had some convoluted positions on rights for Black Americans, which is ironic given the wild fact from the book that Jimmy Carter and Motown founder Berry Gordy are second cousins. You'll hear about that in the interview. When Jimmy Carter was running for office, the Atlanta Constitution refused to endorse him, describing him as, quote, ignorant, racist, backward, ultra-conservative, redneck, South Georgia peanut farmer. He was elected governor, and during his inaugural address, shocked some of those supporters when he made a surprising statement. This clip is from January 12, 1971.
At the end of a long campaign, I believe I know our people of this state as well as anyone could. Based on this knowledge of Georgians, North and South, rural and urban, liberal and conservative, I say to you quite frankly that the time for racial discrimination is over. Our people have already made this major and difficult decision, but we cannot underestimate the challenge of hundreds of minor decisions yet to be made. Our inherent human charity and our religious beliefs will be taxed to the limit. No poor, rural, weak, or Black person should ever have to bear the additional burden of being deprived of the opportunity of an education, a job, or simple justice.
A political career was not Carter's first choice, nor was business or farming. The only reason he ran the family business before getting into politics was because his father died, and he was the eldest child and had to run the family business. Jimmy Carter had been in the Navy at the time, and he loved it. We pick up his story with Carter's time at the Naval Academy in Annapolis. I want to ask about Annapolis. He graduated 60th out of 820 people, men. How did he feel about being a military man?
Well, he had dreamed of going to Annapolis, being in the Navy, ever since he got postcards and other souvenirs from his uncle, Tom Gordy, who was his mother's brother, who was in the Navy and taken prisoner by the Japanese during World War II. By the way, Lillian Carter's maiden name, Gordy, her grandfather had an affair with a black woman, I think daughter of slaves, who bore him a son named Berry Gordy, who then had a son named Berry Gordy Jr.
Heard that before.
Jimmy Carter and Berry Gordy Jr. have the same great-grandfather. In any event, Tom Gordy fired Jimmy's imagination about what a life traveling around the world in the Navy could be, and he wanted that for himself. But he never really wanted to kill people. And so on some level, he saw a strong military, and this is true when he was president as well, when he increased the defense budget by 5% and built some of the weapons like the B-2 bomber that ended up helping win the Cold War. He saw peace above all other values. And a strong military was there to try to keep the peace. And one of the things that Jimmy Carter is most proud of is that there wasn't a single American killed in combat on his four-year watch. And he was the first president since Thomas Jefferson of whom that was true. So he's very intent on keeping peace and human rights foremost in his mind when he's mm-hmm. thinking about international relations. And a strong military is merely a means to that end for him.
I would love you to clarify something for all of us. When people talk about Jimmy Carter, they talk about him being a nuclear expert. What exactly, is he a nuclear engineer? Is he a nuclear scientist? What is his expertise around nuclear energy?
So this became an issue in 1976 when he was first elected, because Jimmy Carter did not lie. You know, the Washington Post thing where they have like five Pinocchios, you know, mm-hmm. or Big Whoppers. He didn't tell Big Whoppers, exaggerate sometimes. And he, in that campaign, in his first book, his campaign autobiography, which was called Why Not the Best, he described it as a nuclear physicist. And nuclear physicists who had PhDs were really upset about that because he didn't have a PhD. But actually, Rickover, for instance, he thought this whole idea that you could only be described as a physicist if you had a PhD was ridiculous. And actually, there is no requirement that you must have a PhD to be a physicist. It's whether you understand nuclear physics at a level that would allow you to have that title. So what happened with Carter was he joined Rickover's nuclear navy in 1952, and he was assigned to develop a submarine called the Seawolf. Now, remember, they were doing the most exciting technological project of the middle part of the 20th century. Think about it sort of as akin to the internet in later years. So they were putting a nuclear power plant on a submarine. Remember, there were not nuclear power plants on land generating energy at this point. This was only 7 years after Hiroshima, right? Nuclear energy, nuclear power was in its infancy. And Rickover was so brilliant that he was building nuclear-powered submarines. And Carter was assigned to manage the development of the second prototype for a nuclear submarine called the Seawolf. And he went and, you know, he, Carter, who, you know, is one of the three or four most intelligent men ever to be president of the United States. His emotional intelligence is another question, but his IQ is off the charts. And he was able in a very short period of time to learn how to be a nuclear engineer and then actually teach the crewmen of this prototype submarine, what they would need to know to run a nuclear power plant on board the submarine. And he took some graduate level classes at Union College because they were building this prototype in Schenectady, New York, near Union. But most of it he learned on his own, and you know, developed a level of knowledge about nuclear power that unquestionably allows him to call himself a nuclear engineer, and arguably allows him to call himself a nuclear physicist, although the latter term relates more to theory, and he was much more involved in the practical applications of nuclear power.
My guest is Jonathan Alter. The name of the book is His Very Best, Jimmy Carter, A Life. Jimmy Carter's career in the Navy is cut short. His father passes away, and he returns home to Georgia to run the family business, which has grown quite a bit. And his brother, Billy, helps him out and takes over the business so that Jimmy can pursue other things, including running for Georgia State Senate. And this has a lot of resonance right now because we are recording this on Monday, January 4th. And Jimmy's first office, he didn't originally win, quote unquote, win, but then it turned out there was voter fraud. And the chair of the Georgia Democratic Party, Charlie Curbo, sniffed it out. A local state representative was going to stuff the ballot box for Carter's opponent. What was very Jimmy Carter about the way he handled all of this?
Well, you know, it is funny that this is coming up now with all the focus on Georgia and also focus on vote fraud. So, you know, people talk about stuffing the ballot box, right? That's almost a cliche. Well, in the case of Jimmy Carter's race for state senate, in 1962, a county boss was literally, not figuratively, literally stuffing the ballot box in order to defeat Carter. And, you know, the election happens. It seems like Carter has lost. And Carter and a couple of his friends who were lawyers, which Carter was not, they went around and they got affidavits. And this is something that Trump and his people did not do to the satisfaction of courts. So they got affidavits from people who had eyewitnessed the stuffing of the ballot box and had eyewitnessed other acts of vote fraud. And they took it to a judge. And the judge, unlike in the 2020 presidential election, ruled in their favor, that they had presented enough evidence of vote fraud to have another election, which Carter won. It's a longer story than that, but it's, you know, it's also an example of Carter's determination. But when Carter, just to move up to the presidency for a second, like when Carter beat incumbent President Gerald Ford by a switch of 18,000 votes in Hawaii and Ohio would have given the election to Ford. Ford conceded early the next morning. And his running mate, Bob Dole, said, "People ask me how I slept last night." He said, "I slept like a baby. I woke up every 6 hours and cried." They didn't try to pretend that they had won the election. And when Carter was defeated 4 years later, he conceded to Ronald Reagan early in the evening, too early for many Democrats. And he didn't try to, you know, pretend that Reagan had stolen the election. Well, I guess the margin was so great that he couldn't have done so. But, you know, Carter played by the rules. He was instrumental in getting past all kinds of ethics reform that protected whistleblowers, created inspectors general, FISA courts, campaign finance reform, all kinds of other things to try to keep elections clean. And he was a reformer at heart in many ways.
One of the very interesting things about Carter during this period, when he is in politics in Georgia, whether it's as a state senator or when he decides to run for governor, is this complex and sometimes confusing way he thinks about race. And you write about it very plainly, that he wasn't on the right side of the civil rights movement for a long time. He made a point of never meeting Martin Luther King Jr., and I think that's quite telling. Why wouldn't he want to be associated with Martin Luther King Jr. and with the civil rights movement as his career is beginning?
Because he wanted a career. And you have to understand that he grew up in one of the most conservative places in the entire South, in Southwest Georgia, in Sumter County. And on the night of King's assassination, for instance, in a tavern on the outskirts of Plains, the proprietor bought a round for the whole house. Carter ducked the civil rights movement for two reasons. First, he was worried about his business because he'd seen one of his rivals, another man who was in the agricultural supply business. Carter's warehouse was Carter's main business, not the farm. Mm-hmm. And so there was an interracial farm very close to Plains, run by one of Martin Luther King's mentors. And it was such a scary place because of the Klan violence and other violence directed against it, that King was afraid to go there very often and said that he was frightened when he would go and see the white man who ran it, Clarence Jordan, who was a very religious man who believed that blacks and whites should live together and work together. And this was, and he was seen as a communist, investigated, repeatedly imprisoned, terrorized. It was white terrorism that was going on in this community. There's no gilding the lily on that. And Carter observed a boycott that was launched against this interracial farm. Nobody was supposed to supply them with anything in the area. And at first I thought, wow, that's really terrible that Carter did that. And then I learned that his rival, who had another agricultural business, sold to the farm. And the racists, they dynamited his place of business. Lucky that nobody was killed. So there were real consequences for his business. And he would sometimes try to do some things, like he refused to join the White Citizens Council, which was kind of, they called it the Uptown Klan. And he tried and failed to integrate his church, not really integrate it, but just allow black people to even cross the threshold of the church as visitors, which they had been allowed to do in earlier decades, like when Jimmy's father died, some of the sharecroppers came to his funeral. But feelings ran so high during the civil rights movement that his church passed a resolution that stood until he was president, that no blacks or agitators were allowed in the church. So he tried to fight against that, but mostly he did not. And then and this was something that took me a long time to research, because he did a fair amount of sugarcoating of this part of his life in his own accounts of it. When he ran for the second time for governor in 1970, he actually appealed to racists. He didn't say anything racist, but he used a lot of code words and dog whistles to, like, states' rights, that kind of thing, saying nice things about George Wallace. And while he had refused years earlier to join the White Citizens Council, in the final days of the campaign, he paid a highly publicized call on the co-founder of the White Citizens Council in order to send a message to rural voters, rural white voters, that he was one of them. And when I asked him, I pressed him on why he did this. And he first said, you know, are we done talking about this yet? And I said, no, you know, President Carter, I have a few more questions about this. And he finally said, look, I had a choice. I could criticize segregationists and be part of the civil rights movement, or I could be in politics. And so he decided that he would be politically expedient without being himself racist in pursuit of the goal of getting political power. And so the question then becomes, well, what does he do with it? And the answer is a lot. And shortly after taking the oath of office as governor of Georgia, he said in his inaugural address, the time for racial discrimination is over. Now, this might not seem like a big deal. And you could argue that in 1971, pretty late, a lot of the rest of the country was, you know, already way ahead of that. But in Georgia, it was a huge deal. The whites felt betrayed by Carter. The black Georgians in attendance couldn't believe that he had said that. They said, he said what? They couldn't believe it. And then Carter went on to be a very liberal governor of Georgia on racial issues. And he basically integrated Georgia state government and appointed black judges, as he did as president as well, and hung Martin Luther King's portrait in the Georgia state capitol, and redeemed himself, and you know, became very close to Andrew Young and Daddy King and others in the civil rights movement. So it's kind of in the better late than never category. And I think it raises questions for all of us in terms of our attitude toward racial injustice in our own time. Like, many of us too slow, too late on things like police brutality. And the issue is, you know, what do we do now? Like, what are our responsibilities now, having come to consciousness about it? And in that sense, you know, we can't all be Jimmy Carter. We can't all be, you know, people who have in African countries, they often name their children after Jimmy Carter. That's how much he's done for Africa. But we can all do something, and we can look at lateness to the cause in context. So mm-hmm. I saw my responsibility as a biographer to not let him off the hook for what he did, or more specifically did not do when he was a young man, but also to give him credit for atoning for his being missing in action during the civil rights movement.
That was Jonathan Alter speaking about his biography, His Very Best, Jimmy Carter, A Life. It's part of our monthly full bio series.